You are a toy! You weren't the real Buzz Lightyear, you're an action figure! You are a child's plaything!
You are a sad, strange little man.
Welcome to Percolated Media's Toy Story Retrospective Series.
Shall we play a game?
No, thank you.
Are you sure?
Join Matt.
Oh, thank goodness you're here!
Adam.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Huh? He's posing.
And Garrett.
Stand still, Godzilla!
As they look at each film of the Toy Story franchise.
Alright, let's review this one more time.
From 1995's beloved original,
let's go home and play.
To 2022's Lightyear and beyond.
Shoots and ladders.
Andy's favorite podcasters will review each Toy Story film and decide individually if the series flies or just falls with style.
Son of a building block!
So get ready to reach for the sky, podcast listeners.
Hello? Check. That better? Great. Everybody hear me?
Percolated Media's Toy Story Retrospective begins now.
All right, let's go.
Toy Story, released November 22nd, 1995. Budget was $30 million, with a box office take of $401.2, including re-release money. And this was directed by John Lasseter. Well, deja vu all over again, Garrett, because this is the second retrospective this year, the first being Scream, that we did at the old place, and are coming back to do it again for the reason that not only do we have a new installment coming out this year to tie in, but we actually have, much like Scream, another movie in between since we did this back in 2019.
We have another movie, and it actually came out when we launched this site, and we were thinking about doing it, and then the person who we wanted to do it with was kind of dragging his feet a little bit, and then he was like, well, do you guys really need me? And we were like, well, okay, I guess not. So we just kind of canned it, and we heard the announcement that there's going to be a new one, and we're like, well, I guess it's all set to go. I guess this is what we're going to do. Yeah, and you know what? I haven't rewatched any of these since we did that retrospective, so I was actually looking forward to this one.
Well, I'm going to go last then, since my thoughts, if you've listened to us before, this will be kind of a regurgitation in certain aspects, but fortunately, one of the things that helps when we redo this is we have a new perspective because one of our co-hosts is not on the previous shows, so they get to go with this with a new perspective. So Adam, I'll ask you, because we talked about The Incredibles a couple years ago. You've sort of tipped your hand about Pixar and your thoughts on them as a brand, but looking at Toy Story, their first and arguably most successful property, actually I would say indisputably, it's their top property. How are you coming at this?
I'm coming at this with a lot of nostalgia. In 1995, when this was released, I would have been 16, I think. I don't think I had turned 17 yet. So junior year of high school, it would have been a date movie kind of thing, I think. And I think that was after a week or two, because you weren't seeing these kind of movies for date weekend. You know, you were taking a girl to see The Little Mermaid or something like that. But this got such rave reviews that, of course, we went to see it. And I'll say, I'm the Disney fan. So I enjoy going to their theme parks, though I've backed off the last couple of years. Blank you, Josh, tomorrow. And some of that. But I live in the shadow of Pixar. I've taken photos in front of that gate. Haven't gone beyond it yet because of security. Haha. But I bring to this, I think, some nostalgia, some fandom. And when we get later into the series, some criticism. But yeah, I watched this and then watched it with my kids, watched it again with my kids. I have the Andy's Toy Box set of the movies. Woody, Buzz, and Friends have been a part of my life since I was a teen.
I don't think John Lasseter stepped inside that part of Pixar either since
in the last Well, based on the reports, he's not allowed to step within 100 yards of anything without a bracelet going off.
I can guarantee he screwed up the last 15 years of Disney CEO succession planning.
Yeah. Well, speaking of planning, you know, Garrett, of the three of us, you have the biggest degree of, I would say, cynicism when it comes to doing these type of kid films. And in particular, you're also reportedly, and this is because I know both of us know you really well, you're not one who's afraid of being the bad guy. And this is certainly a beloved property. So let me ask you, when you went into this and we said, all right, we're going to do this again, were you curious, like, if your perspective was really going to change a lot in the damn near 7 years since we last talked about these?
Well, this one that we're covering today is the one I've seen the most, which shouldn't surprise anybody. And next week's film, I think I saw maybe twice, and I wasn't as high on it as a lot of people were. And three, when I originally did that series, was my favorite of the set. And four, I barely remember. And Lightyear, I still haven't seen. So, to answer your question, when we announced it, I did kind of do the whole put my head down and just kind of sway my head back and forth, say, oh, here we go again. But I gotta tell you, when it started getting closer and I started seeing those trailers, I got pretty excited. So I'm looking forward to revisiting these, even if it's to once again be, I'm not going to say stick in the mud, because I don't think I downright hate any of these films. And again, I still haven't seen Lightyear. Initially, it was something I wasn't looking forward to. Now I am pretty much really all in on it.
Well, I'm in a unique island of the three of us, because I'm the only person on this show who has had children since we last talked about this series. Because that was 2019. So my life has changed a lot. And in particular, the lens I now see these movies through, especially with the fifth one that's coming out, is going to be, because I saw Lightyear at home by myself. I didn't have Riker or, let's see, would Harrison have been born yet? I have to do the math because I don't remember when that came out. But this will be the first one, number five, that I take my family to, which I'm very curious about, because A, that makes me feel tremendously old. Because this property, I guess if there was a second for like millennials, if Harry Potter is like the apex of fandom and nostalgia for my generation, this is probably still on the Mount Rushmore. It's a beloved series. And in particular, if you're my age, the first three films track perfectly on a timeline. I was 2 when this came out. I was 6 when the second one came out. And then the third one, I was in my senior year of high school. Which is crazy timing if you think about Andy's age in the third one. It lines up almost symmetrically. And I've always kind of clutched my pearls a bit every time they've announced one after 3. Because now we've had, this will be the third one if you include Lightyear, since 3. Pixar is one of the things, there was a long time you didn't bet against them. And lately, because there's a lot that changed about Pixar since Toy Story 3, which we'll get into in a couple weeks. But for me, it's always been certainly a huge hallmark of my upbringing. And in particular, one of these movies I have a very special cinematic reverence towards. And in particular, it's a, if you're new to this retro, if you didn't hear the old shows, one of these films I hold in the highest of esteem. I'm not going to show my hand yet, but I did give a 10 back to The Old Place. And I keep those as close to my chest as almost anything with our reviews. So I'm curious to redo this. So I didn't have trepidation. All my trepidation's about number 5, which we'll talk about in a couple weeks.
And what's funny, Matt, is, and me and you discussed this a lot, but you are the same age as my younger brother. And me and him saw the first 3 of these films together. I did not take him to theaters in 95. I didn't see the first Toy Story in theaters, but the second one, of course, third one, we watched together. I believe we watched it when it came out on DVD. I think I bought it and we watched it. And I'm not sure if he's seen 4 yet, because by that time we had both gone in separate directions and we just kind of lost track. So I'm not sure where he went after 3, but my brother being the same age as you, I can say it is a huge part of your generation.
And if you're a Disney fan, this is kind of, you know, it's the genesis of that, because this idea stems from a short film they made back in the 80s, a time where Pixar was just it was like a subsection of Lucasfilm, correct?
Yeah.
Yeah, they started with being based out of Lucasfilm / THX / Computer Technologies, and they were doing a lot of ads. They were there's amazing documentaries on Pixar mm-hmm. that you can go back and watch, and you're like, I didn't know they did this. I didn't know they did this. I didn't know they did this. And it's just fascinating.
Yeah, and what's funny about the originations of Pixar is, as you mentioned, it was a part of Lucasfilm. Lucas, by that point, he'd gone through a divorce. He'd made Willow. He made Howard the Duck. He wanted to do the next set of Star Wars films, but he had no funding for it. Here comes Steve Jobs. And Steve Jobs purchases this technology, and they started it up from that. And from there, Lucas was able to fund the prequels, and the Empire continued to be built, and we had a new one being built right underneath our noses in Pixar. So Adam's absolutely right. There are really interesting documentaries that detail all of that.
What I love, too, is that Jobs, you know, bought into it and became their chairman just because, yeah, they're doing some computer technologies and making ads. So they never became a part of Apple, you know, thank goodness, but they were just something that he was there because they were doing interesting stuff with technologies that were working their way into commercials. And decades later, Pixar, that studio, was still in the same like 5 square mile spot, a little town called Emeryville up here in Northern California, between it's right between Oakland and Berkeley. It is a weird little spot.
It's a weird part of the state.
Yeah. I don't know. I appreciate that they were still, because it was a time where I thought they were gone, a time where I thought they were going to be absorbed and folded into Disney. Talk on that as we get later into these films. They could have easily gone away, is the way that THX did and some other things. But I'm glad they stuck around. And yeah, to see them develop is just pretty massive.
Yeah, and their development, based on what you read and what you listen to, their intent was never to get into filmmaking as far as like...
Mm-mm. Oh, no. Feature length? Nope.
So this whole origin, because this is the film we're talking about, is their debut and was a groundbreaking in so many ways, which we'll get into, started from a short film that they made, they being John Lasseter, who was one of the consultants with computer animation. He was an animator for Disney themselves because he worked on Tron, on the big light cycle sequence in that movie. And that gave him the idea of doing a little forward thinking. Eventually, computers are going to become an integrated part of filmmaking. To what degree? I don't even think he understood that. But the question of doing an animated feature film or computer animation in general was something that he thought about as far back as The Brave Little Toaster. He mm-hmm. put that to Disney, which a lot of people don't know this. It's not part of their lineup. Brave Little Toaster is sort of I don't want to call it an offshoot, because it was produced by Hyperion and the Kusher Lock Group, so it's not part of Disney, but it's funny how many people who worked on that production got involved with Disney and Pixar, but they said it's not cost effective, so we would have to do that as hand-drawn, and they fired John Lasseter. Subsequently, he goes on to work at Lucasfilm, and he becomes one of the founding members of Pixar, and he started experimenting with little short animated films, which in the same way that Pixar's feature films became a staple of the studio, the same could be said for a lot of their shorts that would premiere before the feature films actually released. And this one in particular, Tin Toy, was preying off of his love of classic toys, because it's like a wind-up toy that's featured in it, but for as elementary as it looks by today's standards, it was a huge, you know, step forward at a time where animation was about to be completely overhauled. When you look at the parent, their competitor, Disney, and what they were about to embark on.
Yeah, Tin Toy. You know, I watched it in the week leading up to this. And it's funny. I don't even think my parents had a Tin Toy. I think, Adam, that might be our grandparents' thing, is a Tin Toy.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's primitive, you know, but you can definitely see the origins of where the seed was planted with that particular short that eventually became this film. But there's so many of those seeds that really, really had to all fall into place for this to actually work.
You could also see the parallels between the way that Pixar became what it is now and the way the Walt Disney Company, or mm-hmm. at least Walt Disney Animation, became.
Yeah.
You know, Walt Disney started by doing shorts before other people's movies. You know, Pixar was doing commercials and then they were doing shorts. And the famous story of, you know, Snow White and the Seven Dwarves is going to be Disney's folly, because who is ever going to watch an hour and 30 minute animated movie? And who is ever going to watch an hour and 40 minute computer animated movie? There's a lot of parallels that could be made if you sit back and go, it's pretty amazing that two companies, and again, we'll discuss this, that were about to have a pretty bad breakup and are so synonymous with each other today.
Well, before the breakup, they actually got together because the short got Disney's attention. Mm-hmm. And it was at the time where there was a major shakeup. You had Michael Eisner come on board as the CEO, and you had Jeffrey Katzenberg, who was the chairman, who ironically, much like Lasseter, would go off to form his own company, that being DreamWorks. And Lasseter said, I want to stay at Pixar because I can make history. If I go to Disney, I'm just a director. And they said, why don't we ink a production deal with Pixar? We'll produce their film, because Disney always wanted to make their movies in-house forever. You worked for the mouse, they branded you, and you stayed there until you stopped making movies. But a little movie called The Nightmare Before Christmas, and this goes to show how much power Tim Burton had at the time, he wanted to buy back the rights to Nightmare Before Christmas. And Disney struck a deal with him to where you could make it as a Disney film outside the studio. And it was that system that allowed Pixar to make their movies, I guess, without being under the thumb of Disney completely. Because Disney was about to go through and had begun their renaissance era of Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, Aladdin. They were as innovative and as consistent with their animation as they had ever been after 15 years of not doing so well.
Yeah, and Beauty and the Beast got a Best Picture nomination, which no animated film ever got. And this was back when you only had five films being nominated for Best Picture. We had Aladdin, and then we had The Lion King. I mean, they had quite the run at this time. There was no reason to think there needed to be a shakeup with that in the midst of that run, but that's exactly what happened with this film.
And eventually what happened was you had a lot of the parties get together. Steve Jobs was involved in discussions with Katzenberg. Disney licensed the CAP system that Pixar used. So they were the largest customer for Pixar's computers. And what happened was they said, okay, let's do a feature film. And they talked about a bunch of ideas. One of them was James and the Giant Peach as a animated film with computer animation, which ironically would happen a year later or a couple years after this, with the hybrid style, but it was stop motion because it's Henry Selick who did Nightmare Before Christmas. And the third one, the third idea they had, or the second of three, was Bob the Dinosaur, which technically happened 20 years later, but even Pixar doesn't want to talk about that movie. That's one of the most troubled productions you will ever read. Like, it is the Star Wars holiday special of Pixar in a lot of ways.
Wow. So what was that one again?
Bob the Dinosaur. It became The Good Dinosaur.
Okay. The Good Dinosaur. Yeah. Okay. All right. Wow, I had no idea that originated even back then.
And the last idea they had was, speaking of Star Wars Holiday Special, they were going to do a Tin Toy Christmas as a 30-minute TV episode, like a special. But they said, why don't we just go the extra mile then? If we're already going to commit to going from a 30-second commercial to a 30-minute special, let's just make a feature film. And when that happened, the genesis of Toy Story started, but the movie they initially set out to make was very different than the movie that they actually made. It was a lot more mean-spirited, a lot more cynical, and the titular toys, like the character who would become Woody was a ventriloquist dummy. Mm-hmm. The Buzz Lightyear Mach 1, so to speak, was more like a G.I. Joe type of figure versus a space theme. And then they went, all right, let's make Woody a cowboy. We're being a little bit too snarky and mean-spirited with what we're trying to make. We kind of need to take everything back to formula. Which was smart, because I think history would be very different. If you watch the Pixar Story, which is one of the more famous documentaries they did, you could see some of the test footage they did, some of the designs, and a lot of the animators were talking about, like, it just wasn't working from what we understand.
Yeah, and they were actually given a mandate, I believe by Katzenberg, said, you guys better get your shit in order, or we're not going to fund this thing. And eventually, I think it was Stanton who took the scripts that everybody, including Joss Whedon, put together, and he just kind of jumbled it all together to come up with what eventually happened. But yeah, this was pretty close to not being made.
Well, what also happened was you had writers who had never made a feature film, which, you know, that's a huge jump to make. Like, you think about, independent of the technology, just writing a screenplay, if you've never done it before and you're working with other people, that's a tremendous challenge. And they got Joel Cohen to come in and work on it. They got, you know, you mentioned Joss Whedon came in to help develop this script. And Whedon said that the script didn't 100% work when he first got it, but it had like a really good structure. And Whedon was the one who, according to him, and it sounds like this is true, he was the one who took Buzz Lightyear from being like the self-aware character, he was the one who came up with the idea that he doesn't know he's a toy.
God damn it, you took one of my main notes for later in the film. That was his main contribution. And god damn, think about this movie without that existential crisis. And the movie just revolves around that. So that's a big, big addition. And I think he also come up with Slinky Dog too? Wasn't that a contribution?
He came up with Rex.
Rex, that was his
creation. Yeah. And he also was part of the team that came up with the squeaky aliens.
Yeah, and he had a couple of the jokes here too, which, I mean, if you know Whedon's humor, you definitely know which ones are his. Those contributions are pretty big. But again, Stanton was the one who came in and just kind of made it all work. And kudos to everybody involved for making that happen.
And then they went on to casting, which was a whole
other
thing, because they started with Paul Newman as Woody. I don't know how you go from Paul Newman to Tom Hanks, but somehow that worked. You had Robin Williams, Clint Eastwood were considered. And I guess Lasseter was the one who suggested Hanks, and they used footage from Turner and Hooch or audio of him. And they would animate Woody doing that to kind of basically do proof of concept that his voice would match with animation.
Well, before that, though, they went to Billy Crystal.
Well, they went to Billy Crystal for Buzz.
Mm-hmm. Oh, for Buzz. Okay.
Right. And they used From When Harry Met Sally.
And
Crystal actually turned it down. He said that the movie's not going to be successful because it's animated.
Yeah, this is a guy who just did fucking Mr. Saturday Night, a huge flop. Stuttering John famously asked him at a red carpet, what was it like when Mr. Saturday Night closed on Saturday afternoon?
I love that.
It's so fun. Yep. And he is so fucking full of himself. And he's just flat out said no. And of course, this comes out, is a massive success. And he gets on his knees and just begs, please, 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 let me be in one of your films. So they do a fucking Monsters, Inc., which maybe we'll do one day.
And they auditioned a lot of comedians. Chevy Chase, Bill Murray, Jim Carrey, Jason Alexander, Wayne Knight.
I like the Chevy Chase idea. I think that could have worked.
I
do, man. I think that whole bit of cynicism would have been perfect for this character.
Well, he would have been better suited for the original version. That would have been a lot more snarky and cynical. Because I don't think he could have, at this point, I don't know if he could have accurately portrayed the, like, because Buzz has to be, in the way that he's written in this, he has to be very, pardon the pun, down to earth, but also in his own headspace. And you still have to find a way to, like, make him somewhat likable. And Chevy Chase and likable don't go together.
Definitely.
And I say that as someone who's never had to work with him, but still.
Yeah, and I have big, big thoughts on what Tim Allen does with this that I'll get into later. Basically what Matt is saying is he was, like, the 13th of, like, 15 choices.
Yeah, and they got him because he was working on Home Improvement. Yes. So he was in the studio, he was in the Disney Network, and he said, "Yeah, sure, I mean, it's more money in my pocket."
Yeah.
But he needed an extra bump down the road. Yeah, let me get some money. Right.
So they got everything together, and then every couple weeks, they would start-stop production because they'd get a ton of notes. They basically shut down production in 93 because they called it the Black Friday incident.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, another thing I want to mention, too, is Tom Hanks was also kind of cynical about this, too. And they sent, like you said, they sent him clips of him and Turner and Hooch and animated it. And that's what kind of won him over. But he still was, like, he was in between Philadelphia and Forrest Gump, I believe, when he was in the midst of this. And so it was hard for him to find the headspace to go into this Woody character in between acting like a lawyer with AIDS or being Forrest Gump.
Well, they eventually got additional budgets to improve their staff. They went from a team of like 25, 26 animators to close to 100, which they needed because this technology, when you think about it, you have to animate everything down to a blade of grass. It has to be designed and processed in a computer. And we were still not, all the Disney films were still being hand-drawn. And those staffs, the Lion King had a staff of 800 people. To put into perspective, like, how big these, and that's with hand-drawn. You magnify that with computer. I mean, computers can condense some things, but you need a lot more programmers to handle the hardware and all that type of stuff. Mm-hmm. In total, it was 800,000 machine hours for a movie that is 80 minutes. But the hard work paid off. When this thing came out and it was finally done, and the world laid eyes on it, and not only was it a tremendous success from a box office standpoint, because they said they needed to gross $75 million in 1995 to break even. And the movie made over $350 million on its initial release.
Unbelievable. And the weird thing was, again, I was a teenager at this time. It wasn't cool for me to go to a movie and go to this movie. My brother was only 2 years old. So, like, I really had no reason to see this. However, this was the first year I was working at a video store. And this was back when this video took a year to come out from its initial release. This came out Thanksgiving 95. Came out, I believe, around Halloween in 96. That fucking rush for those fucking videotapes, I will never ever forget how hard it was when that movie was released on video. And yes, I ended up getting one for my brother for Christmas that year. And my mom went to a toy show because she was working for the Raley's Corporation. She was the store director and she had to go to all these toy shows. And they had Woody toys and they had Buzz toys. And she scooped them all and brought them home for Christmas that year. And my brother fell in love with Woody and Toy Story that year.
I mean, Adam, you mentioned you took a date to this. What did you think?
I mean, it was a date. The movie was the last thing on my mind, but it was.
Yeah. You've got a friend in me.
I just remember being impressed because this wasn't what animated movies traditionally were. You know, we hadn't really broken into the ground of things like Shrek and things like that, where families would go, but the teens and adults would get just as much out of it. You know, you don't expect that. You get that a little bit with Beauty and the Beast. Little Mermaid, not really. You know, you can appreciate it, but that's not how it's made. This, I remember going, damn, this is something different. They really did something here.
And I remember getting that videotape and taking it to my girlfriend at the time, Adam, you remember her. And I was like, okay, let's sit and watch it. And I fell in love with it. My initial viewing was, I was pretty blown away by it. And also, when I was working at the video store, they had a video game come out for Sega that same year. And I ended up getting that. And we played that for hours. For somebody who didn't really look forward to seeing this and was pretty cynical towards it, especially after everybody comes up, Do you have a Toy Story? And everything else. I was able to fall in love with this, and that says a lot about what they were able to accomplish.
Well, to show how much this thing made in VHS sales, 21 million copies were sold during the first year of release. You think about home media now, where it's all streaming, like, no, people called hotlines to get physical copies of this. You had a four-disc box set of Laserdisc for this came out. Like I said, it was the highest grossing movie of 1995 in a year that had a lot of big productions come out. You know, this was an original movie. It's not directly based on an IP, but there's some recognizable brands in here. At least one big one with one of the toys. But
one that wishes they were in it.
Yeah, and one that wishes they were in it.
One that begged later.
Yeah.
And you had the Academy give it a special achievement Oscar for being able to pull this off, having the first feature-length animated film completely done with computers. You had it get nominated for Best Original Screenplay, which is amazing considering how many people worked on this thing and how it changed. It was the first animated film to ever do that, in the same way that Beauty and the Beast was the first one to get a Best Picture nomination. And it spawned a franchise, and it built the Pixar empire. You don't get all of their subsequent installments if this was not a hit.
It really is, and we'll get to this pretty soon, but it's kind of like the Stallone story, where if Pixar's struggling and they release a Cars sequel or something that comes out like Brave and doesn't really do much, they turn on the Toy Story machine and they're like, okay, well, let's just put another Toy Story together. You mentioned the synchronicity of Andy in this and, you know, your age and whatnot, and yeah, it's funny that as we get older, they just keep pumping them out, and if the studio's struggling, we'll just put another one together.
Nostalgia is a hell of a drug.
Yeah, no shit.
Yeah, but look, I mean, we got 4 years between this and two. You have 11 years between two and three, 9 years between three and four, and now almost 7 years between four and five. So at least you could say, well, they don't do it every other year like they've done with, I mean, how many franchises put out a movie every other year or every year just to keep the box office taken? But look, Pixar's had other franchises like The Incredibles and Cars and Monsters, Inc., but none of them have really matched what Toy Story is, both as far as the amount of entries, but I would argue critical success, too.
We talk about a lot how, you know, box office and all that kind of stuff, but realize this thing earned on the back of toy stores for a long freaking time, and that could be just as important as any type of box office and video rentals. This thing is a cash cow, even beyond the box office.
That's why it's one of the most ingenious ideas they've ever had, because it's a movie about toys that sells toys, but not in the cynical way that stuff like He-Man did, on top of others. Like, this is, as we'll talk about, there's a lot more to this movie on a writing level and a thematic level than you would expect from a kid's film, which is also one of the things that Pixar is really well known for. I think they're a studio that for the longest time, when we talk about family films, they really were the most trusted brand, because they were for the whole family. Like, it wasn't, as an adult, it's not one of those things you drag your kids drag you to and you just sit there miserable. There's a lot there, and clearly there's more that kids can relate to, clearly, but there's also the more high-end stuff that takes you a little bit to get over. Without going into the, like, I love the Shrek, a couple of the Shrek movies, but they're much more in the risque and the provocative with the humor in a way that this has snippets of, but nowhere near to that extent. Which would have been very easy to do, because we're a couple years removed from Aladdin, which I think also played a big role in that shift.
Yep. Aladdin, Lion King, for sure. And, you know, it's funny you mentioned that, because in 95, I would not have wanted to be caught in a movie theater watching this movie. Like, it would just would have been uncool. But in 2026, guess what? I will be there, and I will be probably going by myself.
You have to be.
Yeah. I will probably be by myself. I don't think Jen really wants to see it. So I'll be at this theater by myself. And yes, I will be happy, more than happy to be there to see it.
Yeah, and I have to take out a second mortgage at the way these prices are with movie tickets and concessions to go and see this, which I'm looking forward to. Even if the movie sucks, it'll be nice to take my family to a Toy Story movie, which I never thought I would say. And not for the reasons of, wow, they made a fifth one, goddamn. Like... Well, to get into the movie itself, we open with what we think is I don't even know what to call it. One of the things that I really compliment this movie, and I'll start out right away, for a movie where kids are not the main characters, because it's, you know, the toys are first and foremost, because as we talked about The Incredibles, that was 2004, they did not want to animate people because it was tremendously challenging. But nevertheless, this opening with, you know, the bank robbery and with Woody and Ham and Potato Head, it perfectly encapsulates what it's like to be a kid playing with their toys.
Definitely. I talked about how I would mingle my He-Man toys with my Star Wars toys, right? And I'd have them join forces and fight Skeletor and Darth Vader together. I always thought about that. You know, what are my toys doing when I'm not in the room? Like, that was just something that you just fantasize about as a kid. And seeing Andy play with these toys definitely made me think, holy shit, you have a cowboy as a toy, you put him in a Western. And if he's your favorite toy, you make him the hero. Like, all of this, even as a cynical teenager, I resonated with.
Yeah, it's just what you did. You talked to them. They talked back. You put them in scenarios. You know, I do think there's something to be said about that. You know, you look today and so many people who write and create media talk about Dungeons and Dragons and how they create these universes and worlds. And that's part of what you did. You know, you made your universe for your toys to play in and combined them together. You know, I talked about, again, on He-Man that, you know, my wrestling figures came in on Battle Cat, you know, and stuff. It's what you did. And it was, I wish I could get back there today.
Yeah,
for sure. I think it also, one of the biggest compliments I give this is that it captures the, like, youthful imagination. And it's not built on pop culture references or pre-existing properties. Like, this is all... I don't know what the opposite of cynicism would be, but this is like the complete antithesis of that, because it's just pure, like, organic child's imagination. And I like how it's the most cliched thing. It's a Western bank robbery with a cowboy as the big hero.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're still going to get pop culture references, though. We're going to have a shining carpet later on in the film. So
we are, but they don't come from Andy's imagination. True. Or,
like, okay, I see what you're saying.
Like, I mean, this series will get some iconic, like, direct movie references, not just in this movie, but there's a literal Jurassic Park reference in next week's film. But you pan out and you get the... All right, I'm going to talk about this now. I give Randy Newman a lot of shit for his melodies and for always sounding the same in everything he ever does. But I think his simplicity in songwriting is actually a benefit to this movie, because it's impossible to think of this property without the music.
Foot, right foot, left foot, right foot. Sorry, Garrett, that's a Family Guy joke. Newman. I think Pixar goes to that well way too often in later films. I think he's perfect here. And I think he creates a nostalgia with his music score, lyric, everything. It is a nostalgia that never existed and always has.
I cannot believe you guys ripped Danny Elfman's Hulk score and you guys are going to praise this.
I ripped everything on Hulk, to be fair.
I hate his sad sack fucking lyrics. The only time I've ever liked Randy Newman is every time I put on Major League, his fucking music opens that movie. And it's actually a really good song. I love that song that opens that film. This makes me happy. Like all of that. Like I can't get into the voice. I can't get into the lyricism. I can't get into anything that Randy Newman sings in these films.
Well, this is the only one I make the exception for.
Okay.
Because the problem I have with Randy Newman is the same one I had with Phil Collins when he did Tarzan. It's telling you how to feel. Like, it doesn't come from the characters themselves, and it's very overly simplified. But you got a friend in me, that's the hallmark, that's the message of the movie in a lot of ways. And I give it a pass for this. Later on in the movie, there's a couple I don't think work. Like, this is the one song I give credence to. But one thing this opening also does very well, it clearly sets up that Woody is the Andy's like number one mm-hmm. toy. Like, and it's not even close.
Yeah. He's on the sheets. He's on the bulletin board. He's everywhere in Andy's room. You're right. This opening scene does do a really good job with that.
Oh, yeah. This is Garrett's Empire Strike Back sheets.
Yes.
That's exactly what this is.
Return of the Jedi, bitch. Return of the Jedi.
I'm sorry. You're right. Empire Strikes Back would have been fleece sheets for the wintertime.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, and it would have had pictures of Tauntauns on it. But you have to establish, like, why Woody... Because the character himself, it's a very difficult tightrope to walk. Because he's covetous of his number one spot, but he does it from a place of, like, I care about my owner. And I want to always do right by him. But at the same time, he is bossy. He is clearly uncomfortable in his own skin to agree at the mere thought of someone replacing him.
He's kind of a dick in this.
Yeah, like he's not, like, neither of these protagonists are 100% likable. And I think that's why, like, that early version, I would love to see in an alternative multiverse type of world, if that movie got made, if you would have been able to get through it, because they're just both despicable.
Now, we're getting into Woody. Let's get into some of the other characters. Bo Peep, is that Andy's toy?
I guess technically.
Or is that his sister's?
Because, well,
maybe it comes with a set of something.
Okay. Yeah, maybe this, like, it came as part of Woody's, like,
okay.
See, the problem with that, though, is it's, you know, we'll talk about it next week. We'll find out that Woody is not quite one of a kind, as we're led to believe. Maybe she came in a set because she's like a porcelain doll, so she doesn't really fit with the rest of them.
Mm-hmm.
But I like that this is, he's not being discriminatory. Like, I mean, look, let's address the elephant in the room. Barbie wanted to be involved in this so badly, and Pixar said basically no.
Well, no, it was the other way around. Pixar begged Barbie to do it, and Barbie said no. They became the M&Ms of E.T. with this film, where, like, they really regretted.
You took that line up from me.
Sorry. They really regretted not doing it. So that's why they came crawling back and wanted to be in the next film. But, yeah, there were a lot of toys. Even G.I. Joe said no, you know, when we get to our antagonist later on. It's just funny. Nobody wanted to be a part of this fucking animated film. Nobody.
It kind of makes sense. I think if Disney made it, they would have. You know, but Disney was just distributing it. So I get it. But yeah, to your point, since I have it written down, you bastard.
Sorry.
This is the M&M to Reese's Pieces, you know, except nothing really came in to fill the spot. So I will give Pixar credit for making gold with what they could do.
Yeah, and it's really the only, she's really the only feminine toy in Andy's house.
Which you need.
Yeah. And I think it's important because it's, you got to have room for both gender, like both boys and girls have to find this movie accessible. And it's so very like adolescent, pre-adolescent boy oriented because you got a cowboy and a spaceman as the two principal toys. But again, with this whole opening, because now we see the universal question we've all thought about, what do your toys do when you're not there? That's such a ingenious mechanism to tell the story through beyond the animation, because you see they have their own society, they have their own hierarchy. Like Woody's telling everyone they're preparing for a move, which I also think is a great device, because there were some of them were worried about being thrown away. And this is great shorthand to introduce all the other characters because you've got Potato Head. All right, let's get into this. One of the brilliant things about Pixar for the longest time was they cast real actors, real comedians, real et cetera, et cetera, because their voices are so unique and recognizable without putting on a disguise. Like, you know that's Don Rickles. You know that's John Ratzenberger. You know that's Jim Varney. You know that's Tom Hanks. You know that's Wallace Shawn. And they don't feel like they have to, because it's animation, like, put on a facade. They're just being themselves, but it works so well.
Well, their voices fit the characters so well. You know, that's one thing we talked about with The Incredibles. Craig T. Nelson and Holly Hunter are hardly household names. I mean, they're well-respected actors, but they're not on the tips of a lot of people's tongues. So they fit those characters very well, and they cast this. Yeah, they got Tom Hanks, who at this point, they didn't know at that time, but at this point was probably the biggest star on the planet next to Tom Cruise. They got him to be...
so much so he had to leave the planet with his next movie, Apollo 13.
They got him to be a part of this, and Pixar would never go after the really, really big names again. The big names would come to them. Don Rickles fits Mr. Potato Head so well. What Pixar does well is just get actors to fit the characters, not big names to sell the film.
And I do think that's where, like, they get actors, which I appreciate to some point. However, there is a massive disconnect with the vocal talent community, it seems like, with so many animated things nowadays. Pixar does it differently, and I feel they cast properly. DreamWorks is the perfect example of where they do that the other way. I remember it was Epic was the movie. We were so looking forward to it. Starring Beyoncé Knowles, who might as well be reading the back of a freaking Cheerios box at the breakfast table. Certain people cannot act and get hired for a name. And when I see a name above a title with an animated movie, I usually get worried. This is populated with people who feel like the character that they're portraying. And I think that is so important.
Well, it helps that Potato Head is written to the point where you think it's Don Rickles improvising. Because he is that, he's playing that type of, like how his stand-up routine was, where he's condescending, he's making fun of everybody, he's clearly antagonistic because he knows how to push the right buttons.
Nowadays, you could do some adjustments with animation and have them. You can't riff back then and say, we're going to fix it later, because animation had such a long lead time in the 90s. You could not say, you know, oh, we'll reanimate this later. There's no reanimating.
No, you have one take, and a lot of times you have to match the lip movements, which is why so many actors struggled with dubbing when Miyazaki's films had to be dubbed. Among others, but, like, you know, I think all the voice work in this is top-notch. In particular, I like that for Andy and Sid, they got genuine kids who weren't, like, didn't have acting experience, which is why I think they feel as natural as they do. Like, they literally had the kid playing Andy, he dumped out all of his X-Men toys, played with them, and they used that as, like, the base footage to get him to do his lines. And in particular, Tom Hanks has a very distinctive voice. Like, you can pick him out of a lineup, but even he's a little bit, I would say of everyone, he's the closest to doing, like, a different voice, because it's somewhat of a higher pitch in moments.
But it fits the whiny.
It's still him.
Yeah, it fits the whiny character that he is, though, which is why I like it.
And I like, you know, he's letting everyone know that no one's being replaced, no one's going to be moved, and everyone else is just, they're like, you can tell some of them are just sick of his shit. Like, this is why, like, you have to elect a new president every so often, because he's being on the verge of being a dictator. But not quite, because he's effective. I like how they have a freaking town council meeting.
Well, yeah, everyone goes to him for the advice. Everybody, like, he is the leader because he is the highest hierarchy in Andy's room. And I like the way that is messed with in this film. I had a favorite toy that I always kept on my bed at night. When I was probably around Andy's age, I had a lion named Leo the Lion. I kept him on my bed. Every time he fell off, I requested from my mom to get a new Band-Aid for it. And Leo the Lion was a huge part of my small, small childhood. And everybody wants to feel wanted. The more wanted you are, the more powerful you are. So I understand why Woody is the leader here, and it's funny the way they mess with that later.
Well, I also like that this... getting Tom Hanks kind of legitimized animation to certain people. But I think that really started with Jeremy Irons for The Lion King. Like, you got an Oscar-winning, like, tremendous actor to voice your villain, and he's so into it. Like, he gives such a great performance in that, just with his voice, that I think that's why you got more big name actors who were willing to do this. But they also saw the returns that Tom Hanks probably made on the back end from the merchandising and the release. And they, I'm sure that also tied in Billy Crystal. But you look at, like, Pixar's next movie, they got, like, what, Dave Foley was the main voice in A Bug's Life? And
yes, he is.
There's some big names in that, like Kevin Spacey, right off The Usual Suspects. You had Julia Louis-Dreyfus, right off Seinfeld. So they got bigger actors, but it starts here. And another thing that I think this opening sets up is, you know, in addition to the move, we also have the birthday party, which also reinforces the idea of you being easily replaced. Yes. And this whole setup of they use the Green Army Men. And this is also cool because they do characters that are unique to the movie, like Woody, Buzz, etc. But then you have Mr. Potato Heads, a Slinky, and the Green Army Men that are like hallmarks of an entire generation. So that way the movie feels original, but it also doesn't feel dated.
Barrel of Monkeys, we'll see later. And yep. Arlie Ermey is so perfect in this role. Like, it really is cast so well.
Well, yeah, and they shoot it like they would, like, The Great Escape.
Yes.
Where they're literally parachuting down. You got the guy saying, go on without me, because he got stepped on. Like, they're also having fun with the tropes that you would do if they were treating this like an actual Men on a Mission movie. Right down to them having to do a walkie-talkie communication.
Yes. Okay, all right. Everyone needs. All right, so I have questions at this point.
Oh, God, is this where we get into the, like, the existential crisis rules?
We're seeing them be completely active. They're using these radios and things, and they are really, really active when Andy's not in the room. What are the rules? Why is it they have to just completely deanimate when Andy or somebody walks in the room? Why is it that it is so important for them to not be seen?
Well, I guess you'd have to look at their version of the Old Testament and see what the rules, the commandments are that they have to follow.
I struggle with that question so much in this viewing. I'm just like, okay, so they're behind the car later on. What would happen if they saw them, like, move out of the way of the tire? My critical mind was really, really moving 100 miles an hour during these scenes.
Maybe 5 years before this, or 2,000 years before this, there was a Stretch Armstrong that got nailed to a cross. And they said that they had to, like, you know, you have to serve your true masters and, you know, you'll be rewarded in the afterlife. I'm sure there's an explanation, but that's not the kind of question that I want to talk about with this kind of...
Okay.
Fair point, but, like, that's the whole thing of, if you ever saw Sausage Party, where they did... It's Toy Story with grocery store items, and they're led to believe that when they get chosen, they go to the great beyond, like the afterlife, and then they find out it's all bullshit. They all gonna die. The movie's very juvenile, it's very crass, but I think it's hysterical. And I think that's also funny because if you know Joss Whedon, he's a notorious atheist. And there is some of that perspective to a degree in this movie. Because Buzz's whole thing is finding out, like, he's not special. Or like, he's not what he thinks he is. And it's almost like his, you know, the spaceman finds out in a lot of ways that, you know, the god that you think of is not, can be a cruel master. And you see in this movie, you have Andy, who's kind of the, you know, the angel, and Sid as the devil. You have literally the toys' representation of heaven and hell living next door to each other. And the interesting thing, I think this is a great screenwriting technique. Andy and Sid never meet. They never talk to each other. You know, you don't see them interact whatsoever. I love how they're distinct, because that would have been the very easy thing to do to explain, like, how the toys go from back and forth. I like that they're entirely separate. And I also love these interactions where they're talking about, as the gifts are being unwrapped, okay, it's bed sheets. And he goes, who invited that kid?
That feels like a Whedon line if I ever heard one.
I thought that sounded like Don Rickles' improv in a lot of ways. Like I love how they have comments for everything until they, you know, they think they're in the clear, but there's the one gift that I assume Andy's mom got him, Buzz.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the old, like, Christmas story technique of putting it behind the dresser and pulling it out when you think all the presents are done being opened. My favorite part of this whole scene is when they're looking out the window. It's like, oh, that looks like a small one. And she turns and it's like a big ass fucking box.
It's a giant, like, yardstick.
Yeah.
But it makes you wonder, what are they gifting a 6-year-old? Like, what's in these boxes?
Good stuff here.
I took it that final present was the one that mom had to admit, fine, his father dropped off a gift.
I thought of that too.
Because I feel like they tried to bring that Spielbergian thought into single parent family.
Well, that's a Disney trope, and it's in a lot of ways. Yeah.
Well, except it's the mother that's alive here.
Right. Yeah, and the father's never mentioned. It's funny. Andy's father is never mentioned in any of these movies.
That's crazy. Nope. I wonder if he's going to get mentioned in 5.
Well, assuming he's in it, which we don't know. But another great thing is that it's almost like they're treating this like it's a hiding the monster, where all they know is it's big, and he loves it. And he plops it down in his room, knocking Woody off his literal bedpost. And now his world shatters completely. And it's not the thing of like, oh, immediately he'll come back to me. No, this is like this is like everything he was worried about. And they thought he was in the clear. And they're like, nope.
And he's right. You know, Andy is absolutely replacing him with Buzz.
And one thing I also have to mention, as far as the animation goes, while a lot of it does look rudimentary to modern eyes, a lot of it still holds up. Especially the detail. If you look at the doors, like wood chips, there's wood chips missing.
I made that note too.
There's fingerprints on the bed knocks, the bed knobs. Like, there's a lot of attention to detail.
I think the only thing that doesn't, and we discussed this with Incredibles, is, you know, human faces a little bit back then. I'm not worried about that, because they do a really smart thing for the overwhelming majority of this, that it's shot like Peanuts, where you don't get the adults. You don't get human characters for the most part. They're waist and below. And the camera angles that they use are brilliant.
Well, Adam, remember Muppet Babies when we were kids? And when you had Nanny walk in the door to go to the Muppets, you just saw the legs. Yeah, I thought of that too. And when they do show the kids, especially Sid, like you feel like he needs to be pushing a lawnmower in a Dire Straits video. Like, it really is.
But it's 95. Did not animate humans for the most part and make them look human. You use exaggerated so that they do this CG wise. You could do it hand drawn, but CG, it just didn't exist.
It works for this movie.
Yeah, because the humans are also not the focal point. They're and you can also get away with them looking distorted because it's through the lens of toys. Yep. It's how they perceive things. Which another thing this movie does very well is the sense of scale.
Yeah.
I think is really well done. The toys don't feel bigger than they should be. I like how the bed looks huge when it's Woody and Buzz on it. And I love how they treat Buzz's, like, right away you see that he is a method actor, basically, where he fully believes he's on a space mission. He's treating it like first contact. And clearly, we tell right away he is there. Woody clearly is threatened by him. Like, in the same way that, like, when a handsome guy walks into a bar and you're trying to hook up with a chick, not that I have any experience with that.
Yeah, Woody turns into a smug prick pretty quick here. It was pretty shocking this time watching it. I forgot just how big of an asshole he really turned out to be.
Oh yeah, and I love, to me, I think the MVP of this movie is Tim Allen. And I can't believe I'm saying that because I normally can't stand him unless it's this or Galaxy Quest. I don't know what it is about his, I think it's because he's not trying to be funny, which I think a lot of times that's his biggest problem. He thinks he's funnier than he actually is. And because he's treating this like a method actor would treat this, I think makes it legitimately funny.
Matt, once again, you're taking one of my notes from later, because that's exactly what I have down here. And I kind of did a little bit of research on this. Tim Allen did say he's a huge Star Trek fan. And the way he approached this, and I think this is genius, he approached it as like Shatner. Like, Shatner is so self-serious. This toy that came from this cardboard box is thinking that that box is a spaceship. And he wanted to take that as self-serious as possible. And it so works for this character and what he's doing. And it really makes for some really fun back and forth between Tim Allen and Tom Hanks as well. What's weird, though, is Woody is the only one who sees that this guy thinks he's a fucking astronaut from space, but he's a fucking toy. No other toy is like that, because I think they're just kind of going with it. I think they don't mind the fact that Buzz thinks he's an alien. Like, they just like the fact that he's here and they're having fun with him.
Well, you get the sense it's also the first new toy they've seen in God knows how long. Like, they're so used to the status quo that the minute, like, a new bright, shiny object, because he's got what he thinks is a laser, which is also one of my favorite gags in this movie. It's just this little, like, spot. It's like that little pointer you use to get your cat to move off the couch. But again, like, it's funny. I watched Galaxy Quest not too long ago. He plays it exactly like he plays Buzz, where he thinks everything is real. And I mean, in that movie it is, but even his delivery is similar. That's why I like that movie so much. But I also appreciate how again, Woody is, he has every right to feel threatened, but at the same time, it's like all great conflicts, he takes it too far. And the movie's also about, like, Andy, to a certain degree, it's about realizing that, and this is part of the messaging for kids, getting along with each other. That's such a cliche, like, almost like a kindergarten level of messaging. But there's a lot more to it than just that. Like, it's not the sole message of the movie. There's a lot more, so I think that's why it plays as well as it does. And again, all the other toys are just smitten with him. Like, they're asking. And this is the one rule I do have. How do the other toys know that they're a toy, but Buzz does not?
Yeah.
I thought about this. And this may be one of the first times that I realized it during this. Buzz is the only new toy. And I feel like almost every other toy that Andy has was handed down from somebody else. Nothing else feels like it had come out in 4, 5, 10 years.
Well, yeah, because he's also like the only one who looks like would operate on batteries, because Woody has the pull string. Mm-hmm. None of the other toys really have any like technology associated with them, because Potato Head, no batteries. Slinky Dog, no batteries. The Piggy Bank, no batteries. So I think that's an interesting read, that maybe it's making a statement on computer programming. And, like, it's his programming that's causing him to think that.
Yeah. It's literally hand-drawn animation is getting usurped by these CG guys.
And Woody makes it now his mission to be like, oh, yeah, Andy's not going to forget about me. And we get the montage of the bedsheets getting replaced. You get the poster being replaced. And, again, I thought this guy was, like, he does try to commit murder for all intents and purposes. But it also does... You don't completely hate Woody because it's not like he's doing a bad job or like being abusive to people. It's just he's so in his own headspace that he can't, in some ways, he can't accept that someone can be on his level.
Well, this was a Katzenberg thing here too, because originally this was a lot more mean-spirited. Originally, Woody actually did push him out the window. And I think they do a pretty good job of making it look like happenstance that he happened to go out the window because the lamp hits him. And I don't think Woody means to really do that. I think just really means to fuck with him a little bit. What I love about this is I don't think Potato Head likes Woody at all, because, I mean, he seems to be against him this entire film. But Slinky is the one who will always go by his side. And I love Jim Varney in this. I love the way he plays this. But when this window thing happened, even he's like, Woody didn't really mean to do that. It's not until Woody tries pulling the Buzz Lightyear, or Buzz trick, that he finally turns against him. But Slinky's always there, and throughout the course of this series, that starts to go away.
Well, it even goes away in the context of this one movie, based on evidence that he's taking it face value because he has to.
Yeah.
But I also like that Jim Varney, like, was his voice always that gravelly?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, going way back to...
Okay, so he sounds like Macho Man.
Yeah, Adam, right, remember...
Where people were like, oh, that's his real voice?
Adam, remember Ernest Goes to Camp? Like, his voice was...
All the Ernest movies. Are you kidding? Yeah. Stay tuned, everybody.
No, that's where I put my foot down. Especially because he looks too much like John Cena.
He is John Cena.
I also like the guise of Buzz. He's not preoccupied with, like, Andy whatsoever. He's just trying to repair a ship to get home. He's treating it like a mechanic. Woody's working under the hood, and you get the goes to show that Woody, he's making it his mission to like tell him that God doesn't exist by saying you are a toy, to the point where it's one of my favorite Tim Allen reads in the movie, when he presses the button to make the helmet retract and he thinks he's choking.
That is a great moment. And me and Adam used to say this line all the fucking time. Adam, remember? We say, you are a toy!
You are a toy!
And then Buzz just looks at him and goes, you are a sad, strange little man. Like, this is, again...
Yeah, that's a little later on.
Like I said, Alan and Hanks are doing some really good line reads here.
Yeah, this is when the power of who you have there, the way they're delivering it, you feel like you can see those two in a booth acting, you know, nose to nose. And it really helps sell all of this.
Well, and there were times they would shoot together, which was not the norm. Like, I was listening to Jonathan Taylor Thomas do an interview. Or no, it was Mark Hamill talking about Jonathan Taylor Thomas on Lion King, where he was like, how was it working with James Earl Jones? He goes, oh, I never met him. Mm-hmm. And you think about the context of that movie and how weird it is to hear that, you know, actors wouldn't play off each other. They would go in, record their lines, and go about their business, and the animators would take it from there. But I think they realized for a story like this, where it's a... Pixar invented this in a lot of ways, or made it one of their staples, the dual, like, the two leads, the mismatched leads. being the main characters. That sticks through a lot of their work. And I think because of that, it was important to have them literally play off each other as best they can. No pun intended. And another thing to give Buzz some kind of pause is every neighborhood seemed to have that one kid who just liked to blow shit up for no reason why. And they look next door and I also like that we meet Sid, who's the main villain of the movie, before the toys like physically do. They just see him across the street. He's literally got one of the toys. Now this one doesn't react because he's like the people at that town in South Park. He doesn't break character despite the fact he's about to be blown up. They don't say F this, you know, like breaking case of emergency. No, he lets himself die for the greater cause. And again, this movie, for a movie about toys, the stakes feel tremendously high throughout all this.
Yes. This is a G-rated movie, right?
I think, yeah, it is rated G.
It goes into some dark places for a G-rated film. I'll just say that. And Sid's room, it just really reminds, like, I know Lasseter and Burton were friends. Tim Burton were friends way back when. I feel like this is Lasseter kind of saying, this is what my buddy Tim Burton's room would probably look like when he was like 6 or 7 years old.
Yeah, the only thing it's missing is a poster for The Cure. Yeah, right. Although there is a Mega Death.
Mega Dork. This. The poster up there, which is so great. I love the image of the animators. Like, they're just thinking about these animators putting, like, what would this fucking cynical, just crazy pyrotechnic kid have on his wall? Oh, yeah, it would be a Mega Dork poster.
But it's also establishing that, like, oh, these toys can actually be, not just be put in danger, but they can be killed.
Yeah.
Which is the thing of, like, you know, we all played with our toys and sometimes took it a bit too far. But, you know, this movie also proves that there are kids who just don't think in those terms and, you know, will go out of their way without thinking about, like, the repercussions of it. Like, he's kind of, Sid's very one-dimensional compared to a lot of Pixar villains. But I think for a movie like this, it's totally fine. Part of it's because the kid is probably going to wind up in therapy based on how this movie ends. But, you know, 2 days before the move, Andy's got to go to Pizza Planet, which you talk about something that else that's lived on for this movie. They built that in one of the parks for a while.
Did they? I was going to ask you guys that.
They finally, at Disneyland here in California, they've had for forever, they had Pizza Port, which is there from 1955. And I swear they actually took that to make Pizza Planet. And they would have during Pixar season, God damn it, they would dress it up. And even though they did such a massive conversion of California Adventure to Pixar, they finally created, and it's now Pizza Planet. And as much as I want to roll my eyes, I still walk in there and go, ooh.
But see, to me, this just looks like another Chuck E. Cheese. Like, it doesn't even look.
Yeah, but you would love it because it has one of the, there's a reference to Alien.
Is there really?
With the whack-a-mole.
Oh, that's funny.
It's the guy's chest. It's this astronaut's chest and all the.
That's funny.
There, I'm like, okay, that's, I can't believe I didn't pick up. That's one of the great things about this movie too, and the sign of great movies in general, when you can watch something new and pick up something every time, even if you've seen this movie several times like I have. And I don't think it's just because we did the retro a couple years ago.
Yeah, I didn't remember the shining carpet from the last time we did this, so that was new to me. Yeah, you do pick up something new, and the scruff marks on the door, all that stuff is, you could tell they really put their minds into this when they were doing it, and all of that is definitely intentional. I know these animators looking at the making of docs, they want to put as much of this stuff in as they could.
And Woody's desperate to be the one toy that's taken to Pizza Planet, so he tries to just innocuously knock him behind the desk, but he makes the almost like a Rube Goldberg thing just by moving the eight ball, because it knocks the books down. They do the Raiders of the Lost Ark thing where he's running and he gets knocked out by the lamp. And everyone being Potato Head, thinks that Woody intentionally pushed him out, because let's be honest, there is probable cause to suspect that based on how he's acted.
Oh, definitely. He's acted like a complete selfish asshole for the last 5-10 minutes. So yeah, it, of course they're going to think that. I don't blame him for it.
And then he winds up taking Woody. And then Buzz winds up in the car and he tries to be like, oh my God, you're okay. Like, and they finally, in a kid's movie, they literally they come to blows and fight each other outside of a gas station. And he flat out tells him, like, you're a toy. He's trying to explain to him that your existence is to please, like, your kid. And he can't process it. He's like, you're a sad, strange little man.
I expect that one of us had that line with our name intro. But I love this. And there's so many Easter eggs here that last throughout so many Pixar movies, from the Pizza Planet truck to the gas station and the name of the gas station. So many things here that just stick around. I freaking love it. And this looks, as simple as it is, it's clean. It's smooth, and it's propelling everything forward. It's a really, really good storytelling as opposed to just a fun movie to watch.
They didn't have too many, I guess you'd say, sets, but these outlines are things to really work around. You know, they had Andy's house, they had Pizza Planet, and they had this gas station, and what's the name of the...
They used Sid's house.
Yeah, and Sid's room. Like, that's literally all, and they kind of just redressed all these places in animation. So they didn't really have too much to work with. They only had $30 million here. The budget's going to more than double next week. So they used their money to their full advantage here.
Well, it's also a great animation technique using scale, because if you notice, they use a lot of wide shots when Woody and Buzz are just standing there to show like how small they are in the grand scheme of this gas station. But like all great ingenuities that toys come up with, they hitch a ride on a nearby delivery truck, because coincidence be damned. And they go to Pizza Planet, which, as I mentioned, has an alien reference. He thinks that the claw machine's a rocket, so he jumps in, and we get the... I guess the claw is one of the most memorable things from this movie. And these aliens, for that matter, because they've lived on through all these movies, and they've had their own ride at Hollywood Studios. They treat the claw like going to heaven.
You know what I appreciate, and I can't believe it. Now they've done, you know, they've been included in shorts. Thank goodness we never got an alien side movie.
Yeah, but this claw would not grasp onto this helmet. That's bullshit. These fucking things are so goddamn rigged. I hate these fucking claw machines at these pizza places.
Yes, it's like Pygal poker. It's a scam.
Oh, don't get me started on Pygal. They miscounted that table last week. I was about ready to punch them.
It was easy. You never win. You just push with the dealer.
Yeah.
Well, Sid not apparently has the greatest luck on the planet. Like, he should go to a casino.
You're not kidding. I thought of that too.
Not only does he get one of the aliens, he gets Woody and Buzz. Now, granted, Woody's grabbing on for dear life, but the fact that he got Buzz when there's no way that claw would grab his helmet.
Nope.
Especially because Buzz is significantly heavier and bulkier than those aliens.
This is a line I've used, and there's so many classic ones used from the other ones. This one here, I don't know how many times the last 30 years I've used the double prizer, and I forget I've ever used a Sid line.
And they wind up going to his house, and it's we had the Island of Dr. Moreau in a kid's movie. Right down to a very subtle joke about hookers.
Yes.
Which, that's got to be a Joss Whedon inclusion.
Oh, stop. We have Lasseter here too. This room, it's just like, I was never one of these types of kids. I was never one to like take my arm off one doll and put it on another to see how it works. I do know people who were like that, but I never was. So I never understood. Like, I thought every single doll was its own unique thing. You didn't need to make them as unique as Sid does here. But I did know kids who did this, so this is pretty real.
Well, also,
raises,
I like that.
Raises my hand.
Oh, that was you, asshole.
Well, that's like the explanation of... He was taking his sister's toys to do this too.
Yeah.
That too.
And this has my favorite line in the entire movie. It's when Buzz goes, "I don't believe that man's ever been to med school."
Fucking Whedon line through and through right there. That was fucking fantastic. I laughed really hard at that watching it this time.
Yeah. I don't think they understand how hard it was to get spanked in a car because you decided that your sister's Barbie might look better bald. But, yep, we got in trouble.
I'm sure this kid's going to grow up to be like a David Cronenberg fan.
Yeah, I don't remember what happens to this kid. Please don't, nobody tell me anything. Stay tuned. So this is all going to be kind of new for me, but I don't know. What's funny is I love how he is looked at as the antagonist of this film, but he's just being just an experimental shithead. You know, like, he's not unlike a lot of the kids I knew growing up. So the fact that these toys look at him as public enemy number one is kind of funny to me. And of course, they were going to blow up a G.I. Joe here, and G.I. Joe was like, "Nope, we don't allow that."
Yeah, it's what, Combat Carl?
Yeah, Combat Carl, yeah.
Who, Matt, have you watched the shorts, the animated shorts throughout the years?
No, because I'm over 6 feet.
So they have one, and it's a Toy Story of Terror. Really fun little horror themed from one of the characters we get in the second one for the most part. And they bring back Combat Carls, and it's a one-arm Combat Carl. So it's just so many of these come back. It's absolutely hilarious.
Well, I like that they also don't. Sid's not like a bad kid. Like he's not. He's just we all know the kid like that, who he's creative like Andy, but just in a more, you know, a further extreme.
Andy's got a single mom, and Sid's probably got a single dad. He's working through, as somebody who got hauled into the principal's office because of his family strife. I might relate to Sid a little bit.
Yeah, it's funny we're talking about this, considering the movie we're also taping this particular recording after, because I imagine this kid going to the principal's office multiple times, or the guidance counselor. But, you know, Woody's not immune to this, because he burns a hole in his head with a magnifying glass.
Now, does that come up later? Like, I was trying to pay attention to see if that marks.
No, it doesn't become, like, a plot point.
Yeah.
It's not carried over to the next movie, so I guess the plastic, like, healed over, or he just, you know, got the toy equivalent of Botox to fill in the gap. But I also like that it's so easy, because you ask the question, why don't they just get up and leave? Well, when you got a dog that looks like it was animated on a Super Nintendo, it's kind of easy to see why. Because of all the things that have transcended and held up pretty well, I think this is the one that has aged the worst.
It has, but yeah. You know what this does that's really brilliant, though? It sets up a plot point for later. And it does it so subtly, but you think about it later when they use this technique for that rocket, and you're like, oh, that's right, that's how Woody remembers this.
Right, and you have to answer the question, okay, why don't they just get up and leave?
Yeah.
Because they can't. But Buzz is still convinced that he's, you know, they're going to fly out of there. And to the point where he turns on the radio and turns on another Randy Newman song, this is the one I can't stand. Mm-hmm. The problem is it's so wonderfully animated and cinematic, where he gets up on the banister or the railing, and he jumps, he sees the window in full display. In his mind, he's going to make it, and then it's just that slide whistle as he starts to fall.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also the sound design of him hitting the stairs, and he loses his wings. And that's like the literal moment of his rock bottom, like his world shattered as much as his wings did.
Yeah, this is the turning point right here. This is when he starts realizing that he's...
But now he goes into the like full-blown depression.
Yeah, exactly. Again, G-rated film.
Yeah, it's the Barbie thing from that movie of like, what is my purpose
then? Yeah.
And I love how, as if he's not beaten down enough, he has to watch a commercial that also reinforces he's a toy, voiced by Penn Jillette, of all people, doing the announcing. And it says, not a flying toy, which is the additional kick in the nuts.
Oh my God. This brought back so much nostalgia for when I would see He-Man toys being played with by kids and want to have one of those toys, you know, and the fact that Buzz is thinking that he is the thing that the toy is based on. No, he's the toy itself that the character is based on is pretty genius, actually. What a wonderful plot point and something that they do really good things with.
Yeah, because you didn't have to reveal it. You could have done a movie where it's just the toys. So to deal with the adult realization that, you know, you're not maybe who you think you are is fucking just so out there.
Yeah, and that you're telling kids that sometimes the world isn't going to work the way that you think it is, or that you're led to believe it will be. But that doesn't mean you can't find a new purpose, because eventually at the end of the movie, he does. And it's about acceptance, and also it's about overcoming depression to the point where he is willing to let himself be blown up because he doesn't care anymore. But that doesn't stop Woody from trying to get back over. He says, Buzz, give me a hand. And he literally throws him his arm.
This is such a great moment. Ha, ha, ha.
And he's having like an existential breakdown because he gets dragged into his sister's tea party, which all her dolls are also missing heads, which is a morbid thing to look at.
This is pretty great. I love how he's supposed to be drunk here. But you think Tim Allen has had a few nights like this?
Yeah, with a little fairy dust.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's so great the way he plays off Woody, and Woody's trying to... I mean, Matt, I think you and I had these conversations when we were in Chicago. Yeah,
except I wasn't carrying your big ass back to the... Then you're on your own there.
Be carrying Rex back to the room.
But I love how he's trying to, like, they're trying to do the thing, the cliche, like, how to escape prison. You know, you throw the rope to the other side and you climb across. And he's trying to convince everyone that Buzz is there, even though he's not talking to him. but he leans too far out the window and they see he's holding a severed arm, which makes Rex vomit. Which, I mean, that's dark, all things considered, because they think he's killed him. Yeah. And this is almost confirmation that, like, not only did he do it, but he dismembered him.
Oh, God, I love animated movies in the 90s.
Yep. And once again, I just have to mention that, of course, as you mentioned, Mr. Potato Head knew from the beginning because, you know, he didn't like Woody much to begin with. But Slinky's the last one to just kind of look and put his head down and pull that shade down. And that's when you realize, oh, shit, now he really has no one on his side. Maybe Bo Peep, but that's pretty much it.
Well, I also like that they come up with ingenious ways to use the toys, like the barrel of monkeys, to hook them together act as the line. Like, that's a lot more. That takes a great deal of thought to come up with those kind of details in a movie that's only 80 minutes. Like, I like that they took the time to do that level of minutia.
I loved and hated that toy.
And this is also where Woody starts to, like, turn a corner, because he's trying to explain, like, you know, while you're not a Space Ranger, you can still, like, you know, there's nothing more fulfilling than, like, being a kid's toy. But he's just not hearing any of it. And what happens is Sid tries to fix him, but he can't do it. Because, again, to Adam's point, Buzz is a lot more complicated of a from a mechanical standpoint. And he just gives up and says, all right, I'm going to blow him up. Which makes me wonder, where's this kid getting all these rockets from?
Okay, thank you for bringing this up. Can you order these things, like, how does
there's a rocket in the mail, like, you used to buy those, like, they used to buy those rings in the back of comic books.
I thought of it like when you would buy a model rocket, and you would get the little rocket part of it. I mean, we went to model stores and bought model rockets, and I guess you could order them, but you can't anymore. I'll say that.
Adam, these are firecrackers, dude. Like, this kid is ordering firecrackers.
He must live in New Hampshire.
I was going to say, a lot of areas, and Garrett, you grew up where I did, we had to go across this bridge because it was technically a different county.
Uh-huh,
and as soon as you crossed the county line, there were booths set up for like a mile on each side.
No, that's like it is in Rhode Island. You had to go to New Hampshire to buy rockets or like extend fireworks beyond just like firecrackers and a little like cherry bombs. Mm. Yeah. Everyone, welcome to the economics of the 4th of July. Where we live. You know, so this is where it comes to blows. Sid's about to blow him sky high, and this is where Woody has to, for all intents and purposes, break kayfabe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because, like, one of the golden rules they've set up, they don't outright say it, is you can't out yourself that you're sentient. But I guess this is where, you know, the break glass up in case of emergency, because he sends Sid into therapy by making him not just talk to him, like, he doesn't just play back the, like, the stink in my boot line. No, he's talking full dialogue. He does the exorcist head turn. You see the mouth actually move. I mean, I'm surprised. This is shockingly dark and morbid for a movie like this.
And stupid. Because they say before this starts, he goes, okay, we're going to have to break a few rules, guys. Again, what are these rules? Why is it they can get away with it here, but they can't get away with it the rest of the film? I'm sorry, guys. Like, I cannot help but think about what the logistics is of this and what they're allowed and not allowed to do.
Well, I think it's two parts. I think, one, it shows what happens to Sid by revealing it, not just because of the cruel way, but just by revealing it. Sid, at least in this film, appears to go nuts. But I think there's a story here at the end of the day where when they finished making this movie, they went, no, let's leave this movie with leaving kids with the impression that your toys are real. They're real to you. And that's what happens by doing this. These toys are real. It's not just in your head. And I think there's something beautiful about that. I'm being sentimental, but I think there's something there.
Well, it's also saying, hey, don't buy all of our toys just to blow them up with rockets. And even the sister holding the doll, now she's going to have like dominion over him and have turned the tables. But the movie also forgets, oh yeah, that's right, or doesn't forget that they're moving, you know, because the house is all packed up. They get in the moving truck and they get chased by the dog. You know, Buzz fights him off. Woody climbs into the truck. They have to use the RC car to go back and rescue him. And again, Woody could just say, F you, I'm leaving you, but he does go back for him.
In an animated movie, let's say, this is a pretty kick-ass action sequence. The way that this is storyboarded and done would fit in Fast and the Furious. This is freaking cool.
Fast and the Furious.
Well, yeah, but sentient toys is more plausible than half the shit they do in those later movies.
Well, I think Woody has something to prove here. I think Woody realizes that he fucked up and he needs to win his friends over again. And how better to do that than to rescue the new boy in town who he is also trying to win over because he has lost his confidence. He doesn't have any of that confidence in the beginning of the film and he realizes he needs that. That is quite the arc for this little toy to have. In a movie about sentient toys, I was not expecting to feel for that. And I think it's going to be my review of all five of these films. Well, six, maybe, when we get to Lightyear. But I enjoy the fact that those are the feelings I'm having as I'm watching this, is we're seeing a character arc.
And he realizes he's not doing this for himself. I mean, yeah, he wants to get back, but that's not it. He's doing this for Buzz and for Andy.
Well, there's also the, all right, so I'm going to have my Joss Whedon conspiracy hat on. If you notice all the other toys, they only get on Woody's side when they see the literal proof that Buzz is alive. And I think that's a knock on these Christian fundamentalists who only believe shit they can see with their own eyes. Like, it's very much, this is like a clear atheist perspective of like, faith cannot exist unless you physically appear. So that's my rose-tinted glasses moment for this. And again, you talk about setup and payoff with the rocket trick to outsmart the dog. Because they ignite the truck and they use the magnifying glass, like kickstarts his mind against. So again, on a writing level, for guys who've never written a screenplay before, they know how to do setup and payoff. Right down to the infinity beyond line that they use. Well, I mean, as implausible as it is that they're gliding at this speed.
Well, yeah, and they also bring back, I do love this line too, where earlier Woody was so cynical towards Buzz, when he does that creative fall, which we didn't really talk about, but God, that is so well done. Everything was just so coincidental, but yet it looked like he was flying through the room. And even Woody's just like, you're just flying. You're just falling with style. And he uses the same line here, but he does it to lift him up. And I think that's, again, just really great writing.
Agreed.
And they safely land through the sunroof, and a little bit of Disney nostalgia here with Hakuna Matata playing on the radio. Kind of the snake eating its own tail there, but they were still separate entities, so I guess they were playing nice. And they get back inside, they're in the new house. It's turns into a Shane Black movie because it's Christmas all of a sudden. And they've accepted that, like, you know, Buzz is complacent. This is his new lot in life. It's his new purpose. And they think they got nothing to fear. And much like the first, how the movie opens with them getting a new toy that they feel threatened, we find out Andy got a puppy and they start to nervously laugh because those things can be an instrument of destruction.
What is more dangerous to a toy than a goddamn dog? What a brilliant line to end on. I mean, God, I had so many Princess Leia toys growing up. I don't know what it was about Princess Leia that my dog liked, but I was never able to keep them for longer than a week because I'd come in the room and she'd be in pieces. there's just something about toys and dogs. Dogs will tear these toys apart. And it's just so funny. Just, again, great way to end this movie.
Especially because they were just terrorized by a dog.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, that's it for the movie. I mean, it's only 80 minutes, but there's a lot there that's lived on 30 years. But, you know, Garrett, 30 years, 7 years since we did the show, scale of 1 to 10, what do you give Toy Story?
Oh, boy. You know, I was nervous coming back to this because while I had pretty good memories of it, I wasn't sure, A, leading up to the movie, if I could bring as much enthusiasm for it as I did last time, and B, if it would live up to what I remembered it being. And fortunately, both things are right. What this movie lacks in animation, I'm not going to say good animation, but in great animation, it makes up for with a really witty script, with some great arcs, and things that both adults and kids can love. There's a reason why this movie launched a studio. And we look back at 1977 Star Wars, we think, wow, that was the beginning. I know Bluth Studios, Don Bluth Studio, would go out within 5 years. In a lot of ways, this started and ended a lot of things about animation, for better and for worse. We'll talk about it as we get further into the series. But for this particular movie from 1995 to get into my cynical 17-year-old soul the way it did when I watched it initially, it had to have done something right, and it does. It's just funny that a character as smug as Woody is, to come out smelling like roses at the end of this is, again, a big compliment to the script. I think every single actor is cast very well. If you don't look at the humans too hard, it's a really well done animation job. And we didn't talk about this, but even the leaves like just look a little weird when you look at them closely. But still, go with this movie. Enjoy its writing. This is a solid 8 for me. Just really fun time watching Toy Story again. I'm looking forward to getting further into this series. 8 on 10.
Oh, we got an 8. I think that's, I can't remember because it's been so long since I've done those shows, but that's pretty close, if not identical to what you scored it last time. All right, Adam, are you going to go higher or lower or the same?
No, I remember when this movie came out, I remember some people being a little skeptical about it. And then I remember the reviews just talking about this being a game changer. At the beginning of this, I compared it or made references to this and Snow White and the Seven Dwarves. And I think I did for very, very good reason. And I think it still stands the test today. Watch Snow White and the Seven Dwarves. You're going to see the things that are limits of its time. And I think you will still be astounded by what that movie can deliver. And I think this movie does that as well. Yeah, there's some things where you go, okay, CG from the 90s and really from the early 90s when they started doing this. But the way that this will still make you feel, it'll make you feel like a kid. It'll make you feel like an adult. It'll make you feel like a toy. It will put you in places you may not realize, especially coming back now just over 30 years later and looking at it through nostalgia, rose-tinted glasses. The cast on this is superb. The vocal direction is astounding. The animation directing is very, very good. The story is quick. It never really breaks. You don't feel lapses. You don't feel of a moment where you're like, okay, come on. And I thought I remembered that in this, but rewatching it, no, this thing is crisp. It's tight. It flows. And everything pays back that gets set up very early on in this film. It's not perfect. I do think we may see perfection later on in this series. And I think we may fight about that later on in this series. But this is I've used astounding twice, but it is a fantastic start to a rocket ship of change in the industry. And Toy Story is phenomenal. And it still is 31 years later at the time that we're recording this. It's not perfect, but I do think it's damn close. I'm giving this a 9, and it still works for me today. 9 on 10, Toy Story.
All right, 4 on 10. Good night, everybody. No, I'm just fucking with you all. As the person who, I would say, fell into the target audience the most, it's difficult for me to divorce nostalgia from my modern sensibilities because I'm not who I was when I first saw this, clearly. But now I've taken on a new lease on life with how I'm looking at these movies. I'm thinking about it through the lens of like not just myself, but the next generation, and being able to watch this with my kids, all these movies, which I'm doing as research. When the boys are over, I do my rewatches with them and I'm taking notes. Although some of these movies I basically know by heart, not just because they tug at your heartstrings, but I think that kind of reinforces the staying power that this singular movie has. Because it, not only is it all family, I think it's multi-generational. Now that we're 30 years removed, and just the thought of playing with toys nowadays, even that feels antiquated with technology and the way kids kind of have to grow up a little bit quicker in modern society. But there's still that nostalgic angle we all have of remembering where we were at that age that Andy is. And I think that's where a lot of the staying power from this lies, in that that type of innocence and imagination doesn't go away. No matter how old you get, I think that that's like a core memory in like the Inside Out Pixar stance. And look, it's the movie that spawns not just a franchise, but a whole new wave of animation. Everybody tried to be the next Toy Story, using inanimate objects, using computer animation, using big names. Often imitated, never duplicated. I know that's a cliched statement to make, but it really is it's the first and arguably the best of the series. We'll discuss that because we got some pretty heavy hitters to come. But at the same time, looking at it just as a achievement, it goes beyond just the animation, which, look, it's going to not hold up as well when 30 years have gone by and you look at I mean, we just did Fire and Ash. Computer animation has just evolved to the point, it's like going from the Stone Age to Edison discovering electricity. But this movie's not a relic because it's timelessly told with its period, with its ability to not rely on what was popular at the time. I think that was clearly intentional. And it's still one of the stronger Pixar films they've ever made. And I think it's very telling that the staying power this movie had, considering their next film, the knock was, well, it's no Toy Story. Almost every review for A Bug's Life led with that statement. And part of that's because it's a high bar to cross. So I'm with Garrett, though. I settled on an 8 just because of there are some minor, not issues I have, but in the grand scheme of like where how I feel about some of these particular installments, I did have to weigh that. But it's still, you know, what needs to be said? Hopefully we don't have to do this retrospective a third time when we get to Toy Story 8 by the time my kids are in high school. And to the surprise of, you know, cynicism, we talked about how this movie really is not. The cynical thing was to do a sequel, though. And they made one, but it did not start out much like this movie. The original vision was not what we got in theaters, because it originally was not going to go to theaters. But it did. And Garrett, and actually both of you, did you see Toy Story 2 in the theater?
I didn't know.
I did, and the reason I did was three words. A Bug's Life. There's a lot to be said about Pixar. There's a lot to be said about the franchises that have come out of it. I'm still waiting for my Bug's Life sequel because I loved that movie, still do to this day. I still resent that land got taken away at Disneyland and for some piss-poor Avengers campus that they built. I was such a massive fan of Pixar coming out of A Bug's Life that when this was made, I couldn't wait to go see it. I love the behind-the-scenes stuff about it. I love that this is the film that was going to break up Pixar and Disney until the end of the day. But yeah, I was right there for Toy Story 2.
I love the hills that you die on, Adam.
I was such a Dave Foley mark.
The ant hill, if you will.
Ants and Bug's Life that same year, man.
Oof. I remember. Oh, I just watched Bug's Life for the first time a couple years ago. Jen sat me down and watched it. She couldn't believe I'd never seen it.
It is great. It's great.
I do want to mention some closing thoughts on the one we just watched, Toy Story. You know, what the power of this film, guys, to me, and the reason why it works so well, not only does it do what a lot of movies now do, which, you know, it plays off nostalgia. I mean, I'm sure a lot of adults went to this movie that had a Mr. Potato Head. I'm sure a lot of adults went to this movie that had Army Men. But it also just has that really, really resonated story of insecurities and introducing children to things they would have to deal with later on in life, you know, and I think that's what gives it the power that it has and why it was able to spawn at least one sequel, and then we'll talk about the rest of them. But in watching it for this review, that really stuck out to me this time is, yeah, we're seeing Barrel of Monkeys. We're seeing everything that I played with as a child, and that is a draw, but it's the story itself and the presence of cynicism without being overly cynical. And that's what really made it work. But Toy Story 2, you know, when I finally got around to it, I was not a fan. I watched it one time. My brother got it for Christmas that year, and I didn't watch it again until we did it for that retrospective. So I'll be interested to rewatch this. I don't know where I'll fall when I rewatch it this week. Am I going to fall in the camp that I didn't think it was that great because of how good the first one is? Or am I going to be, it was okay. It was pretty good. I don't know. So I'm looking forward to this.
Well, I have my thoughts, and I guarantee they're not going to change because I've seen the second one. I've actually seen it more than I've seen the first one.
Interesting.
Like, I wore out that VHS tape. And like I said, you know, it came out at a time where, you know, Pixar, all their biggest success was Toy Story. And, you know, how do you follow that up? Which is the question that people have said about these movies every time they've announced another one.
Mm-hmm.
And the consensus has always been, yeah, they justified it. Will we feel the same? Remains to be seen. But till next time, we're going to put our toys back in the box. And until next week when we review Toy Story 2, that wasn't podcasting, that was Falling with Style. Thank you, gentlemen.
I'm going to have some words with this lily pad and let her know how things are run around here.
Try to stay calm, Jesse.
Buzz, you know me. I'm the definition of calm.
That's not going to work. Thank you for listening to this edition of the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, exclusively here on Percolated Media.
Good job, troops.
Come back every Friday as new retrospective reviews are posted weekly on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
Let's go home.
I'm glad I got to see you again.
If you like this retrospective review, check out our archives at percolatedmedia.net, as we have tons of franchise reviews such as Star Wars, the Pirates of the Caribbean film series, Indiana Jones, Masters of the Universe, the ongoing Marvel films, films of the DC Universe featuring Superman and Batman, the Jurassic Park and Jurassic World film series, the Beetlejuice films, the Planet of the Apes franchise, the Incredibles films, and so much more.
I don't believe that man's ever been to medical school.
I was listening. I'm always listening.
This podcast is not affiliated with any film studio or network, and all opinions expressed on the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast represents the opinions of that individual. Any similarities to any and all things associated with the films in question are strictly coincidental.
Ah, that went well.
It's good to see them fighting again.
It sure is.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is an independently produced podcast, and it's thanks to the support of listeners like you that help keep it that way. Please like and subscribe, as well as leave a review on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
You have saved our lives. We are eternally grateful.
Come on, I'm not lying down on the job.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is produced by Garrett, Matt, and Dave.
You would not believe what I've been through tonight.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is edited by Garrett.
You got a lot to look forward to, folks.
Scheduling done by Matt.
My hero!
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
Potato Head, Mr. and Mrs. Trikus, check, 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 check.
This podcast is a Percolated Media production. Copyright 2026, and any and all music, movie, and sound clips are used for entertainment purposes and review only.
You still worried?
About Andy? Nah. It'll be fun while it lasts.
I'm proud of you, cowboy.
Besides, when it all ends, I'll have old Buzz Lightyear to keep me company. For infinity and beyond. Was about to go through and had begun their renaissance era of Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, Aladdin. They were as innovative and as consistent with their animation as they had ever been after 15 years of not doing so well.
Yeah, and
so I'm sure. Go ahead.
I was just going to say,
because the problem I have with Randy Newman is the same one I had with Phil Collins when he did Tarzan. It's telling you how to feel. Like, it doesn't come from the characters themselves, and it's very overly simplified. But you got a friend in me. That's the hallmark. That's the message of the movie in a lot of ways. And I give it a pass for this. Later on in the movie, there's a couple I don't think work. Like, this is the one song I give credence to.
And I forgot Phil Collins did fucking Tarzan. Wow, that's quite a pull, man.
Tarzan is a banger of an album. I have that CD.
I like the Broadway version, but I hate Phil Collins. I hate the way if we ever do the Disney Renaissance, I will have words, because remember that was all the Renaissance films to go on a side tangent. You had the characters actually singing the songs, and all of a sudden they're like, oh, let's get a popular musician to sing every fucking song and tell you how to feel. I can't stand that.
Donny Osmond's in Mulan.
Yeah, and I mean, look, freaking, why is Hercules all gospel music like you're in a church in Alabama? That also doesn't make any sense. But one thing this opening also does very well, and it's not the thing of like, oh, immediately he'll come back to me. No, this is like this is like everything he was worried about, and they thought he was in the clear, and they're like, nope.
Yeah. And he's right.
What's that? Yeah, I'm sorry, I stepped on that. Go ahead.
And he's right.
Well, that's like the explanation of he was taking his sister's toys to do this, too.
Yeah. And that, too.
Like, because we've all had that, you know, the older, some of us, I'm the oldest, so I can't bitch. Garrett is, too. So we didn't have
almost a generation between his, though.
Yeah. And it'd be funny because I would come home from school and I would come in my room and see my sister play with her Barbie dolls in my wrestling ring. So
let's see. So me and my younger brother, who's the second oldest, he's 7 years younger than me. So we're far enough apart to where this never happened. But yeah, my Nate and my sister Abby, they're 3 years apart. So this, I lived this just as a spectator, although not to this degree. And this has my favorite line in the entire movie. They know how to do setup and payoff. Right down to the infinity and beyond, god damn it. To the infinity and beyond line that they use.
Hi, toys! Hi, toys!